Welcome to the 12th Annual Homelessness Marathon, a national dialogue on homelessness and poverty in America. The toll-free number anyone may call for this broadcast is 1-877-NOBODY-8. That's the word nobody followed by the number 8. If you're homeless, formerly homeless, or afraid you're about to be homeless, you may also call 1-866-OUT. There are some things you can't say on the radio because their words deemed to be obscene. And there are some things you can't say on the radio because their truths deemed better off unseen. One of those truths concerns the country in our hemisphere with the best reputation for hurricane preparedness. Unfortunately, it's not the USA. We'll talk about who it is and say some things you're not supposed to say on the radio right after this. This next story is rebroadcast with permission and was first reported in October.
This is Day to Day. I'm Madeline Brand.
I'm Alex Chadwick. In Ohio, there's a voting experiment underway. Voters can now register and cast a ballot there on the same day. This privilege lasts only 3 more days, and that's the last day, October 6th, that Ohioans can register to vote in this election. From member station WCPN in Cleveland, Mari Saito reports.
When you think of ways to spend your honeymoon, driving around homeless voters in the pouring rain in Cleveland probably doesn't top your list.
Hey, thank y'all so much for coming out.
But that's what Yoni Stadlin and his new wife Vivian Lair are doing. It's been 2 weeks since the 20-something New York City couple got married. They are parked in their rented red minivan outside a homeless shelter, waiting to ferry residents to the County Board of Elections to register and vote.
We figure the beach will wait past November 4th. The beaches will still be there, hotels will be there, but this is too important to wait. This isn't going to wait.
Stadlin is one of over 200 volunteers working in 8 Ohio cities this week. The PAC Vote Today Ohio wants to take advantage of this unusual one-week window where Ohioans can register and vote on the same day. Founder Tate Hausman says he has a budget of less than $100,000, but he's hoping to turn out 10,000 new and unlikely voters from college campuses, food pantries, and inner-city shelters this week.
When you register someone early and then you have to go back to turn them out to vote, you lose a lot of people. And so what we are doing is capitalizing on this opportunity where it's this one-step process where we won't lose people. And we'll actually get their votes in the bank early so that we know that they're counted on Election Day.
Hausman is hoping that many of these hard-to-reach voters will cast their ballots for Barack Obama. While the McCain campaign is encouraging their Ohio voters to get to the polls early, the state's Republican Party has been fighting same-day registration and voting in court. Kevin DeWine is with the Ohio Republican Party.
We believe the potential for illegal election activity is very real, and the evidence is clear in other states that this process has been abused and the warning signs are beginning to appear here in Ohio.
DeWine has blasted Ohio's Democratic Secretary of State Jennifer Bruner for playing what he calls partisan politics, but his arguments aren't holding up in court. The state Supreme Court, 2 federal courts, and the 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Cincinnati have upheld Bruner's directive and are allowing same-day registration and voting to go forward. First-time voter Jan Moss Jr. says he wouldn't have come out if the process wasn't so easy.
I think my vote would make a difference. I think it really would. I think that's a blessing just to come out and do that all at once.
The tables were turned just 4 years ago when Ohio's then-Republican Secretary of State Ken Blackwell was the focus of controversy. State Democrats argued that Blackwell was passing voter rules that favored his party and trying to suppress voter turnout. It's pretty clear on these Cleveland shuttles that most of the homeless are voting Democrat, even former Republicans like 52-year-old John Berhansel.
Last time I voted was for Ronald Reagan. Just feel that we need a change and that I'm just scared of the Republican administration, what they're going to do.
This Sunday, rock star Bruce Springsteen is scheduled to perform in Columbus at a rally to turn out more unregistered voters before the week is over. Election workers in Ohio hope that early voting will help ease long lines on election day.
We can do another ride of other people.
Back on the van, newlywed Stadlin and Lair are shuttling voters back to homeless shelters. On their first day, shuttles like these ferried more than 450 Ohioans to the polls. Stadlin hopes his van will be busier as the week continues and word gets out. The last day of so-called Golden Week is Monday, October 6th. For NPR News, I'm Mari Saito in Cleveland.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Homelessness Marathon, where the numbers to call in are 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. In this hour, we're going to talk about things you're not supposed to say on the radio. We're going to ask the question, does anybody maybe do a better job of dealing with hurricanes than we've done so far after Katrina and Gustav and Ike and so forth? And could it even be that it's somebody we don't get along with so well is doing better than us? I'm going to talk now. We would like to welcome to the broadcast Randy Poindexter, who is a member of the U.S.-Cuba Hurricane Conference. Randy, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
Thank you, Michael. I'm happy to participate with you. And greetings from New Orleans, where tomorrow morning is Mardi Gras Day.
Well, actually, my name is not Michael. That is my son, who is our chief engineer. Oh. My name is Jeremy, or on the air I go by the name of Nobody. But in any, never mind. Let's not get too technical about this. Randy, you were in New Orleans during Katrina?
I evacuated.
Okay.
But did lose my house and my roof and a lot of my possessions, and then I evacuated again and was hit by Rita, where I evacuated too. So I'm actually a survivor of both Katrina and Rita. So I have a lot of experience with hurricanes and actually took our satellite dish with us. And so we were able to watch the local news the entire time and follow what was happening in New Orleans. So, and have been back in New Orleans ever since and been a part of the rebuilding of New Orleans.
But the point is, you're not an armchair philosopher. You suffered from these hurricanes. You've had personal experience.
I have, and held with a lot of my friends who have suffered through.
Okay.
And been, I'm a local activist. And have fed the homeless for many years here, too. So I have, unfortunately, a lot of experience in dealing with the hurricane effects on a community.
Well, you got to watch out for them activists, I always say.
I'm telling you.
Well, we've stooped pretty low. We got an activist on the program, huh? We're trying to run a respectable show around here. Well, okay. So, first of all, before we move on to the issues, let me ask you, Randy, are you rebuilt? Where are you housed now?
Yes, I am. In fact, I'm right off Napoleon Avenue in New Orleans. I bought somebody else's flooded house and redid it rather than try to do my own house. And I'm happy to say that we're part of the great Broadmoor community in New Orleans, which is New Orleans' premier recovery neighborhood. We lead the way and probably have the largest number of rebuilt houses, restored houses in the New Orleans area. And I think that we've accomplished that fact through neighbors communicating with each other and lending each other support and forming committees and block captains, and which is something that I learned from Cuba. Is that sense of community, which as an activist, I'll have to be able to speak to you about that.
All right, I want to get to the Cuba part. I want to get to that, but I even if it is that activism stuff. Oh. But we've had Curtis waiting on the line a long time here, so I want to take Curtis's call, and then we're going to talk about what might be different in Cuba. Those numbers are 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. Curtis, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon. Thank you for your patience.
Hi, thank you. Hi. Well, I don't want to take away from the Katrina situation at all, but my situation isn't really connected to that.
You're not taking it away. You're in Fresno, California, and we based our broadcast 1 year in Fresno, so we're very interested in what's going on there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, here's what happened to me when I was growing up with my family. We had PG&E going on and off, and I'm from a single-parent home, and I also came out as homosexual at a young age, and I guess I was unknowingly giving myself to a marginalized community, and so I became homeless because my mom couldn't pay the bills, and I couldn't get a job being in a marginalized part of the community. And so that's where I stood, and she found a man, and she moved with him, but I wasn't welcome to move with them, so I became homeless. And I wasn't homeless to the point of sleeping outdoors except for a couple nights.
Okay, well, that counts.
However, I slept with friends on couches wherever I could.
That counts, too.
Always looking for work, And the thing is that the homeless population, they're not uneducated usually. I'm a very educated person. I consider myself to always have been educated and always been geared towards education. And so basically there's a misnomer out there that these are lazy people, or that these are people who don't try, or people that just want a free ride, or people who are happy the way they are. They have psychological issues. Well, the truth is that they're marginalized people to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Well, many, not all. I mean, as you say, some people who are homeless are college educated and so forth. But there are many marginalized people who doesn't take much to push them off the margin.
Yeah, it doesn't take much. And then on the issue someone else had said earlier was immigrant workers or outsourcing. It's all taken away from renewing the United States economy, and that is beyond true. That is, you know, the immigrant workers, they're not necessarily taking our jobs, but the jobs should be up for grabs for the homeless population or for people who actually need it in our own country first.
Yes, I think that the immigrant issue is a very complex one. I unfortunately think neither side on that has really quite got it right. I think that's a more complex issue than I want to get into. But there certainly is a lot of concern about it. That we can say for sure.
Well, the thing is that someone had said specifically about Mexican immigrant workers, and they didn't go into it. But I really want to get into that, and that's because they're in a country that is so in poverty. They're just trying to escape, really, and they're just trying to find a better place to stay. And whether they're coming here illegally or legally, they do deserve the right to be here.
Well, I think there's a lot of disagreement about that, but we all agree. I certainly believe they're good people. That's not really part of the issue. Curtis, we got to move along, but I want to thank you very much for the call and for participating in the Homelessness Marathon. Good talking to you. Randy, let me get back to this question about Cuba. We're talking about Hispanic people, and let's talk about Cuba. From start to finish, you know, what would Cuba have done differently in a situation like Hurricane Katrina?
Well, if I may address that and also address Curtis's situation, because it does apply. And when I say activist, Jeremy, I want to say that I've been an advocate for the homeless and the mentally ill.
Right.
So in that sense, that makes me an activist. I have been interested in the way Cuba does a lot of things for quite some time, because I think on many levels they approach things like hurricane evacuations and healthcare and education on levels that we could certainly observe and learn from. And I think Cuba is a very touchy subject in this country, only because we know so little about Cuba, and the country has been victimized and demonized by the media only for political reasons. But when one actually has a chance to go there, and I've been there My next trip in April will be my 11th trip, and I've been all over the island. And one learns from the Cubans that there are many ways of doing things, and in some ways much better than the way we know how to do things here.
Well, you know, if I can just stop you for 1 second, Randy.
Yes, sir.
I would say this to people. What you think of Cuba is one thing, whether you have a well-founded opinion or a badly founded opinion, whether you're right or wrong, that's all one thing. But what we can learn from Cuba is another. After all, after World War II, we did not hesitate to learn about missile technology from the Nazis, and it's not an endorsement of Nazism. To say that Cuba might, you might like the Cuban society better, someone might or might like it worse, but to say that we can learn from them is not the same as endorsing everything about their society.
No, and I think we would leave politics out of this because we're looking at apples and oranges in terms of their political systems, comparing our political systems, and I'm not going to advocate one over the other. What relates to our conversation tonight
right.
is how Cuba handles hurricanes.
So let's hear about it.
So what I have been doing with the Center for International Policy in Washington is observing how Cuba handles hurricanes by we have been taking emergency management directors from the Gulf Coast states, including Pensacola, Mobile, and Gulfport, Mississippi, your own Joe Spraggins,
mm-hmm.
and also some authors who have been involved in writing books about Katrina, Ivor Van Heerden from the Louisiana Hurricane Center, went to visit with the Cuban specialist in Monterrey, Mexico, at the Institute of Technology, and found that we had a great deal to converse about. And then we met again in Cuba this past spring. And the primary person that we meet with when we go there is their meteorologist, Jose Rubiera. Jose is primarily their weatherman. Whenever a hurricane comes to town, then he is on television night and day telling people what is happening with the storm.
Okay, well, let's stop there then. If we're talking about procedurally, the first difference we would see between us and Cuba, you're saying, is what? That there's more consciousness of the weather there? We do get weather reports here all the time. What's the difference?
We do. What happens there is they have it broken down into four phases. They have an information phase 72 hours out. Then an alert phase, then an alarm phase, a recovery phase. And it's all based on levels of communication during which the whole country or those areas of the country that are affected are going to participate. They know exactly how they're going to participate, on what levels, because once a year in May, at the end of May, for 2 days, they have what's called the meteor exercises, during which they have a two-day drill when everybody in the country participates, not just the officials who would be involved in hurricane rescue or whatever, but citizens, neighbors, children, everybody on all levels participates in emergency procedures.
Okay, so let me stop you because I want to take a call too. Okay. But what you're saying, the first thing you're saying is they don't just get a weather report. The weather report is tied to a set of procedures, which the entire nation by this time understands what they're supposed to be doing in relation right. to what they're hearing. Something we don't have here. We just get the weather and then we make what we make out of it, right?
So exactly. That,
okay.
Organized.
All right. Those numbers to call in here, 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT, or if you're local, 463-1035. Chris in Bend, Oregon, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
Yeah, hi, I'm here.
Great, Chris. What would you like to say?
Well, I work at a homeless shelter.
Okay.
And I have heard you several times describe how some people have brought up the issue that, you know, this is very important to talk about what happened with Katrina. Everybody, I think, fairly well understands that it was a travesty in the way that this government dealt, or our government dealt with the issues there. But I think during this period of doing the homeless marathon, to It's difficult for me to listen to this. We keep coming back to what's going on in post-Katrina and hurricanes and so on. I work in a homeless shelter. I'm seeing a disaster writ large across this nation in this economic downturn. And I'm seeing things that I didn't think I'd ever see.
Well, tell us about it. Tell us, Chris.
Well, I work in a homeless shelter. I see this every single day. Actually, in the, well, at least for our time here, between the 7 and 8 o'clock hour, you got a phone call from one of the residents at the place where I work. And I'm telling you now that what we see are people who are literally shell-shocked. I mean, perhaps maybe this is what was seen after Katrina, people who essentially don't know where they can turn next, what they can do next. Even here in Bend, we had quite a few years of boomtown in which there were lots of houses being built and construction was incredible and housing prices were going up endlessly. And that has all fallen apart in the last 8 months. And people who used to be able to say, if the economy here in Bend is bad, I'm going to go to St. Louis, or I'm going to go to Portland, or I'm going to go to Chicago, or I'm going to go to Atlanta. Those places aren't there anymore for them to go to. We have a whole spell of people in this country right now who do not have the resources or the ability to weather this upcoming storm in our economy. And it's a little frustrating. It's a little frustrating to not hear this being discussed, because those least able to deal with it are the ones who are feeling the most terrible effects now.
Is this the first time you've heard our broadcast, Chris?
No, actually, it's not. I understand. I know how the broadcast works. And I understand that you have a focus. You have a focus on what you're doing for this particular broadcast. What I'm saying to you is that things are at a critical level right now in this country, across the nation. And that's the only point I wanted to make.
Well, Chris, I want to address it, though, which is, look, you're certainly right. I think we're in a situation where you can't talk about everything at once.
And I appreciate that. I really do appreciate that.
And we certainly, God knows, this program of all programs means no slight to the people who are struggling in all kinds of ways around this country, as you've correctly said.
Right, and do understand, I'm not actually criticizing you. What I'm saying is, I understand.
Yeah.
I actually worked in radio for a lot of years. I understand that
you're one of those.
Yeah. You had a structure that you created for yourself. You had a focus you created for this particular program.
Right. But, Chris, I want to ask you a question. It's fine, but let's move by this. I want to ask you this. Because, see, there are many links between the two kinds of situations. And the thing is that Katrina poses questions about what does it mean to have recovery? And people down here, of course, have not nearly gotten the help they should get. Now, the residents that you're seeing in your shelter, let's talk about them for a moment. What kind of things are out there for them to recover in this economic crisis that we're in?
There's nothing to recover. I mean, there really is literally nothing right now. You are at, particularly in this kind of economy, it is the bottom level tier jobs. It is the jobs that don't really pay you enough to live on your own, but you might be able to cobble it together with a few other people. Those jobs are gone. It's seeing what happens when somebody who's a senior citizen, who's making $600 a month on Social Security,
right,
who is renting a room from somebody and comes home one day and finds out the house is being foreclosed upon. Where do they go next? Well, we're seeing certainly more seniors staying at the Bethlehem Inn, which is the place I work, than we've seen before. About a third of our residents are mentally ill. There are people who have just basically survived for years and years and years, not making much money, not saving much money,
right,
but surviving, who suddenly have the rug pulled from underneath them, and they suddenly find themselves coming to a homeless shelter. Usually what's happened is they've burned through every resource they can get through before they get to the point of showing up at a homeless shelter. What I'm saying to you is that we literally don't know how to predict what the next 6 months are going to bring.
No, nobody does.
We are standing here watching things like our local mental health being cut back one day a week. These are people, a lot of these folks, if by the time you've been into a homeless shelter, chances are at least you're depressed.
You should be
able to get involved with the mental health system. That's being cut back because the states aren't having money. What I'm saying to you is that it really is literally on the ground right now is frightening in ways at the age of 50 I never thought I would see.
How long have you been in this business, Chris?
2 years now.
Okay. And you're saying, so people understand this, that you're seeing a marked worsening of the situation just in that time.
Oh, yes. Oh, my Lord, this used to be a boomtown. You could hit the ground running here in Bend. And at least, you know, you may not have any resources, you may not have much money, but at least the next day you could make $60 cleaning up construction sites. Mm-hmm. You know, at least you could do that. Those days are gone. You can't even do that. They used to close down restaurants here in the afternoons because they couldn't pay wait staff enough for them to want to work there. Those days are gone. We're watching restaurants disappear. We're watching, it's truly remarkable what you're seeing right now. And the trick of this is that those least able to weather this kind of storm, are, it's like the canary in the mine, that analogy you keep bringing up. It is exactly what we're seeing right now. We're seeing this sort of creep up the economic ladder now. So now we're seeing more and more people who never thought they would be at a homeless shelter are suddenly at a homeless shelter.
Now, Chris,
and of course, our resources, I mean, we exist primarily on donations. Well, where does those donations come from? People who supposedly had excess when they could give donations. Those days are gone.
How many beds do you have, Chris, there?
Well, we can, if we had the staff, we could run 80 people living at the end. Now, we do men, women, and families.
But is your occupancy rate rising, or the number of people presenting themselves to you rising?
It's constantly fluctuating. It's constantly fluctuating. There are people who are, you know, getting frustrated with here, and they try to cobble together enough resources to go someplace else, and then guess what? A month and a half later, they come back. We see them come back. It didn't work. Okay. We have family units right now at the Bethlehem Inn. Those are all filled up. We are constantly have demand for families looking for places.
That's a problem around the country. Chris, I wish I had more time for this because you're giving us an important piece.
I just wanted to make that one point. I do understand your structure. I just want to make sure the larger picture doesn't fall away.
I'm very glad you did contribute that, and I want to thank you for the call. Randy, let's get back to hurricanes, okay?
Oh, it's fascinating, and I agree with Chris, and I think
this
point is well taken. And I think that one thing that is most important, that if nothing else can be taken away from what I've learned in Cuba about the way they handle their hurricane evacuations, their disaster response, is that everything is community-based. That they are very well organized, that it does not take a lot of money to save people's lives. And one thing that I ask about, because here in New Orleans, and as a result of the storms, we have had a lot of post-traumatic stress syndrome, and I ask how the Cubans handled that, how they handled the emotional distress after the disasters. And they have social workers that prepare them to go back, so before the kids can go back to school, they're interviewed by social workers. They take care of their people. They have a different kind of government, so that they evacuate their people, they evacuate their pets, they evacuate their appliances. They know where everybody is going to go. They evacuate people with disabilities, the pregnant women. Everybody knows where their evacuation spot is going to be.
Let me stop you there, if I may. Please. So the point is that they break it down in community, so everybody in the community knows the needs of their neighbors.
And that is something that we can translate to our country.
Well, what about the argument somebody might say, Randy, well, we don't want busybodies knowing all of our business, and they can do that because they're communists. But down here, you know, I got a right to my privacy. I don't want my neighbor knowing everything about my business. I don't want them knowing about my appliances, my pets, everything. I'm an American. I don't have to put up with this.
That's true. One can be an isolationist. But in this time of crisis, where we're looking at more and more natural disasters occurring, and they're going to occur, and we're looking at economic downturns, we're going to have to learn to rely on our neighbors, not fear our neighbors and be isolationist. I think we're going to have to build our communities back together, learn to become friends with our neighbors.
So what you're saying, if I understand you, Randy, is whether we like it or not, that being another issue, this is what works. You're saying this is what works in Cuba.
This is how their system is based. It's community-based. They are organized, and it doesn't take a lot of money to do that.
Okay. Let me take someone at the mic. We have a gentleman at the mic. Sir, your name?
Mims Carter.
Mims Carter, and welcome to the Homelessness Marathon, Mims. What would you like to tell us?
Well, I work for one of the nonprofits down here that's been working in recovery since Katrina happened. And I want to chime in on some of the issues that other people have brought up.
Okay.
One of the problems we found... get closer? Okay. One of the problems we've had is with funding. You know, we've relied on volunteers to do a lot of the work down here, and they've been great. Most of the work that I've been involved with has involved donated money. We had coalitions of volunteer groups and funders of donated money to help build houses in here, and that money is pretty much gone now. It probably all ended the major funding, Red Cross and people like that, the Mississippi Hurricane Relief Fund, which had money from people who donated to the state of Mississippi after the storm. And we did great work with that money, but it's all gone. And right now, the only funding left is Katrina money from the federal government that's been given to the state. And it's been awful hard to access. So right now, we're in the stretch of time between where the donated money has gone, and it's been awful hard to access any federal funds for us because of basically a lot of bureaucracy.
Well, let me compare notes between you and Randy. Randy, Mims here is here as part of the relief effort, and he's largely been dependent in other organizations as well on donated money. In Cuba, is a recovery effort from a hurricane largely dependent on donated money?
Absolutely not. Nothing is based on a monetary system in Cuba. In fact, when people lose their items, the government replaces them. Their most basic living items are replaced. If your house is destroyed, the government replaces that house. It's not an issue of fighting for it like it is here. If their appliances are lost, the government replaces that. We saw a photograph in the newspaper here of Cuba handing out mattresses as soon as that big tidal wave washed through Havana. That wouldn't happen here. It certainly hasn't happened where we live. So I know what you're saying about the funding drying up, because yes, it is. And that's why we're going to have to learn to depend on each other and learn to help ourselves and to hold each other up.
Are there organizations like International Relief and Development, which you work for, MIMS, is that
yes.
correct? Are there actual organizations? Is it all community-based, or would there be an organization that in Cuba has some equivalent of that, that specializes in some aspect of reconstruction or whatever?
Well, in Cuba, what they have are everything starts with the neighborhood.
Uh-huh.
It moves to a municipal and then a provincial level, just like we work with the neighborhood and then a city and state level. And what I would suggest is that especially to your listeners, and we're dealing with issues of homelessness, one thing we have done here in New Orleans that has been effective is that all of us activists, people who work on issues of importance to our area, get together once a month at a breakfast. And we talk about the issues that affect our community. And everybody has a chance to talk. And then we have a speaker that affects, that addresses the most important issue. And I think that would be very important for each area now that's within our broadcast range to consider doing, is that there be a lot more discussion within areas so that people do become more connected and do become more involved with their community, because the volunteers, the funding, as our callers have mentioned, are drying up. And the problem in our country, as we heard with our caller Curtis, is that feeling of isolation. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing you don't find when you visit Cuba. Nobody is isolated. They do feel they have that support of the community.
Okay. Well, Mims, what would you comment on that as opposed to the kind of thing that you're struggling with here?
Well, I think that's a very good point. in a sense, New Orleans can do that. Out here on the coast, we're kind of spread out more. We're more rural. And we do try to get together, but it's a little harder to bring the whole Katrina-affected community from state line to state line across the coast together. We do attempt to do that, but in a lot of cases, some of the communities, especially out in Hancock County, which, you know, Kathleen Johnson and others can speak to, are very isolated. But then again, you look at Cuba, which has a lot of rural areas, and they seem to do okay with the fact that it's scattered communities. One of the things that I see, we don't have that step from local community to area to state, all kind of supporting and talking back and forth to each other. I know in Mississippi, we're the only Katrina or Rita affected state, for instance, that didn't have housing assistance programs for people who suffered only wind damage. So about 70% of the damaged structures down here were not eligible for housing assistance that came through Katrina community block grants.
Well, let's stop there. Randy, I mean, I thank you. I'm not trying to cut you off, but I want to focus on these issues. Randy, would this be an issue in Cuba? I mean, we've talked about a lot on this. I don't know if you've heard the broadcast up until now, but we've talked a lot about all the bureaucracy, all the things you have to qualify for, which is really difficult. In Cuba, would they say, well, you had wind damage, but you didn't have water damage, or water damage, you didn't have wind damage? Would you have
absolutely
that kind of thing?
Not. No. Absolutely not. And that's one of the things I so admired in listening to in participating in the discussions. And also, I have to mention, you know, Cuba offered to send New Orleans 1,500 doctors right after Katrina. And, of course, their offer was refused. So we were really felt blessed that we felt their offer was so generous. So we met some of the doctors who were going to come to Cuba. But they were very eager to give us this kind of advice as to how they handle the evacuations. And we have another team going down in April, which includes the mayor of Galveston, their city manager, and their port director, and also John Barry, the author of Rising Tide, which is the wonderful book about the history of Mississippi and describing the flood of 1927. And so what I found is that they're so generous in sharing this great information about how they handle disaster management. It's not just hurricanes, but this information would be applicable to other parts of the country, people that are experiencing tornadoes and wildfires and everything.
Oh, sure, but Randy, let me ask you this. Supposing your house was damaged in Cuba by one of these hurricanes or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Okay, you've been flooded and your house needs to be gutted, or your porch was knocked off and one of your bedrooms washed out to sea, whatever it would be. What happens? Does somebody come around and assess it? Does somebody come around and help you rebuild? What actually happens there?
The government rebuilds your house. It is not a question of whether or not your house qualifies for it. It gets rebuilt. But, you know, it's a funny thing there. People are very good about helping each other. And it's quite possible that the neighbors will help put it back together before the government gets there.
Well, we've certainly had a lot of volunteerism here. That's one thing you cannot take away from Mississippi and or from the United States. We've certainly had that good spirit. But you're saying you wouldn't have to worry about filling out 50 million forms and qualifying.
No.
You'd get that aid, and you'd know it. You'd know it would come.
They don't. In fact, they have made a lot of breakthroughs in cutting through the red tape.
Okay.
And, of course, they've just had their worst hurricane season ever. They had hurricane winds of 212 miles per hour. One-third of the island was destroyed by hurricanes, and yet they could evacuate 2.5 million people with almost no loss of life, and they know, I think in 12 years, they have lost 23 people.
Oh, that's more than I had heard. But in any case, in 12 years, 23, we lost that in
the
first 10 minutes.
Last season.
Yeah.
Because of horrible storms.
All right, hang on a second, because we got callers who have been very patient. But please, Mim, stay at the mic, and Randy, stay on the phone. Jim from Portland, Maine, are you still there?
Hey, Jeremy, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Jim. Is this a gym I take it? I know a couple of gyms in Portland, Maine.
Well, I was one of the volunteers from MPG that we met when you flagshipped here a few years ago.
That's right, and we were very grateful for that support, and welcome to the marathon. What is on your mind tonight, Jim?
First of all, I want to thank you again for coming out and doing it. You look great. I saw the first couple hours on the thing. You look great. And,
I kind of look like a cross between George Clooney and Cary Grant, right?
But I do want to thank you for bringing this back again, and thank you for going to Mississippi, and especially bringing up this subject because, as you know, U.S.-Cuba relations politically are not the great. You know, they appear to us on the surface as not being great, but yet, I'll preface my question with this little tidbit. I don't know if you're a baseball fan or not, but I think you are. But Bill Lee, who used to pitch for the Boston Red Sox, he brings a group of guys down to Cuba every year. They go down, they play tournaments in these small, little, tight-line communities, you know, communities where there's really not much. They go down and play, and there's not much to do, and people are open to it. From what I'm hearing here is that the Cubans are open to discussing how they handle these procedures with folks like Randy. And Randy, thank you for coming up, being here this morning. I really appreciate it. And then, you know, people from, like, she's talking about from the mayors from Galveston, Texas, and these other places. Why aren't, and I guess I don't know if Randy can answer this or not, but why aren't people from FEMA, why aren't people from our National Weather Service, why aren't people from the federal government getting involved in these meetings as well? Especially outfits like FEMA and those kind of sort of federal agencies to really bring it to a national level. Why aren't we hearing more about it?
Well, Jim, before I turn this over to Randy and thank you for the call and raising a good issue, I just want to say one thing. I try never to censor anyone on this show except for profanity and stuff like that. But as a New Yorker who has all his life rooted for the New York Yankees, I want to say... want to say, could you please keep the Red Sox out of this broadcast? So, Jim,
I can't help it if we whipped your butt the last few years.
Listen, there is a low I'm not sinking to on my show, and that's going past the line. Cuba is one thing.
We can agree to disagree.
Yeah. Well, talking about the Cubans is one thing. The Red Sox, forget it. So I want to thank you very much for the call and for raising
a
good issue. And let me have Randy answer it. Randy?
Thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you very much. Randy, please excuse this terrible thing you said. But beyond that.
Jeremy, he raised a very interesting question because at our first conference with the Cubans in Monterey, we were all on the way down there, and we had one of our participants was from the U.S. Weather Service, who is a Cuban who works in Florida, Lixian Avila, he was originally born in Cuba, but he works with the Weather Service, but he was on the way down to Monterey, and the U.S. State Department called him back in Cancun and told him not to attend the meeting in Monterey.
So we shouldn't even learn whatever they... We can learn about making war from the Nazis, but not about saving our own people from hurricanes
from
the Cubans.
And this was only to discuss hurricanes.
Okay.
We never discussed politics the entire time.
And we're not talking about politics at all here. Right, I'm not discussing, we're not endorsing the Cuban system, and we're not dissing it. We're just not discussing it. It had nothing to do with this discussion. We're talking about what helps with hurricanes. Mims, let me ask you at the mic.
We're trying to save lives.
That's all we're talking about, right? I mean, if the Cubans had a cure for cancer, would we take that? I mean, I would.
Excuse me. Now, they do... You know, they do pharmaceutical research.
I know
they do.
They do
not have access to their drugs. They have scorpion farms, blue scorpion farms, because they do have a cure for cancer. We do not have access to it.
No, that's interesting.
It is not available. available to us in this country.
Okay, I don't want to get too far afield. Can they cure every cancer, or they have made progress, is what you're saying?
They do have a cure for some types of cancer.
All right, that's interesting.
So we do not have access to
it. I hope listeners will, if they're interested in that topic, will research it. But I don't want to go too far afield. MIMS, you work with International Relief and Development. Has your organization ever sent someone down to Cuba? You're working here post-hurricane, so have you tried to learn what the Cubans know?
I really don't know if International Relief and Development, they are all over the world. I don't know if they've been to Cuba. One of the things I want to say is where we're doing this broadcast from was part of my hometown in Pasco, Christiana. I lived a few blocks away. And there was an apartment complex here,
right.
A low-income apartment called Signature Lake. And I would imagine that there might have been more people lost to Katrina just here at Signature Lake than you said the Cubans have lost in 12 years of hurricanes. So, maybe we can learn something from them. It's something that I wonder about. We have a lot of issues, and we maybe don't have to reinvent the wheel ourselves. Maybe we can learn from other countries, just like, and I don't want to go too far afield here, but like with health care, you know, if we need nationalized health care to redo it, we don't have to start over. We can learn from other countries, even if we don't like their political system or agree with them. There are certain elements of the way they run things that maybe we can learn things from and maybe not lose as many people as we have.
Well, Mims, before I let you go, and I want to thank you very much for sharing with us. I know you have some expertise, great expertise on what's going on here. Do you happen to know what happened to the Signature Lake apartments? For the listeners who are just tuning in, where were they? There were maybe 360 apartments. They're all gone now after Katrina.
Yeah.
Were they, as they say down here, slabbed? Were they just disappeared, or were they just damaged so badly they had to be torn down?
Well, I was back down here on the coast. I had to evacuate my family, but I came back 2 days after the storm, and I think it might have taken me a few days to get over here, but there were, it's hard to picture it exactly. I might be imagining things, but there were some structures still standing here. Mm-hmm. Some of the ones that were probably closer to the railroad tracks, closer to the beach, were gone. But there were some still standing, as I recall.
The ones that were standing, obviously, were badly damaged, too badly damaged.
I would say probably too badly damaged to
repair.
To repair.
Some were just, again, the slang around here is slabbed. Some of them were just slabbed. There was nothing left
but the
slab.
Some of them were just slabbed, yes.
Yeah. And we're about, what would you say, three long blocks from the ocean here? We're not right on the ocean here.
No, we aren't. We're, the railroad tracks would be about three blocks, and we're about another block.
So, yeah, maybe a quarter of a mile, maybe even a
yeah.
little more, something like that.
Yeah.
That that should bear witness to people out there to the force of what happened, that 360 apartments that were maybe four blocks, a quarter of a mile from the from the Gulf, gone, with loss of life.
Well, yeah, and for Pasco Christiane, in total, I think 90% of the housing was destroyed.
Yeah, well, I heard 80, but why quibble?
They
were wiped out, so... Mims, I want to thank you so much for being at the microphone and for sharing your thoughts with us here.
My pleasure.
All right, great. Randy, I'm going to want to take a call in a moment, but, walk me through it. Okay, if you've just been in Cuba, if you know the answer to this, and I know that, you know, we saw with New Orleans, 7 days, what did it take? Just to get food to the Superdome, you know, get water to those poor people, 5 days, whatever it took, too long. How long after a hurricane does it take before you start getting people coming around talking about let's put your house back together?
In Cuba?
Yeah.
Their system is such that they evacuate, they're well prepared, they have food, water in place in the evacuation shelters. As soon as the hurricane has passed, the danger is passed, they assess the damage, and then they return to start cleaning up. Everybody participates. the children in schools are educated to repair. It's a family thing. It's not that the government goes back and starts cleaning up. Everybody goes back and starts cleaning up. If it's safe. If it's not safe, then they don't go back in yet. So it's not the kind of thing. Once they've evacuated, the shelters that they go into are already prepared so that they have the food and water and medicine and doctors and veterinarians there at the evacuation shelters. But again, it's not they are left to fend for themselves. It's not a theory of like we have in New Orleans, run for your lives, and everybody goes every which way. I know in our last evacuation, supposedly it was very organized, but it wasn't. It was, I felt it was a disaster because our people were left to fend for themselves and people could not afford to evacuate. You're talking about homeless people here, homeless people, and we have three times as many homeless people as we did prior to Katrina, cannot afford to evacuate. Poor people cannot afford to evacuate. And New Orleans is a very poor city.
Yeah, that was one of the problems, too, is that Katrina hit on the 29th of the month when the people who were poor, their checks had run out.
Did not want to leave town.
Right. Well, let me take a call here.
Your check.
This, the numbers to call in here on the Homelessness Marathon are 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. And on the line, we have Shannon. Thank you for your patience, Shannon. Welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
Hi.
Hi. Where are you, Shannon?
I'm in Bangor, Maine.
Okay.
Yeah, that last statement just, it made my heart drop, you know, that they didn't want to leave. You know, I know what that's like to be at the very end of your monthly cycle, you know what I mean? And when Hurricane Katrina hit, you know, I had children, and everybody up here sat there, you know, watching on the TV, you know, just babies dying and people not getting their basic needs met. If they could frickin' swim to a McDonald's fast enough and stand in line with a dollar, or, you know, any one of these corporate places with a dollar, then you might get taken care of, and the best they offer is, you know, a flyby from President Bush over it, and Condoleezza Rice is out shopping for shoes. You know, I mean, I've been listening to this show for the past 5 hours, and it just brings up so much for me because I can just see the common thread through it all is that we really, really, especially if we're thinking about, you know, New World Order or setting a standard or any of that, really need to question the profit-driven motivation, because the Earth's only so big. We only have so many resources that we can totally contaminate, you know, and we're the richest country on the planet. Everybody knows it. You know, the people that we keep waiting to come rescue us are too busy getting theirs. And I do believe that the people need to get in it together. We're the only ones that are taking action, and they just keep suppressing it. You know, here in Maine, I was hearing stories of guys that wanted to take their caterpillar shears down there to just do something to end the suffering. And I personally homeschool my child. You know, I am not going to give my life over to a system that, in the bottom line, when there's a human need, especially, I mean, you have guys that were police officers. You know, I've been listening to your show, people that, quote, did everything right,
mm-hmm.
did everything right that you're supposed to do. And still, when you're hungry, you're cold, you're suffering, you're in pain, it doesn't matter, because there's still, it's all about the profit. And it's the biggest dilemma and paradox and cruel thing that I've ever heard of. And I mean, I have children. I'm very concerned for my future. I'd love to think that, okay, I can just get in it together in my community and take care of as many people around me as I can. But the reality is, you know, I go to the grocery store and I see everybody just standing there looking at all this food they'd love to buy, but instead they're saying, okay, what 5 items do I need the most, you know? And to a certain point, you really start to have to question, you know, is it the dollar bill that's keeping it all back and so painful? Is it that dollar thing, you know?
Well, Shannon, you know, I'm glad you brought this up, and I want to make a point to the listeners out there. By the way, those numbers are 877-NOBODY-8866 and left out. We don't screen calls, and I don't tell people what to say on this show.
Uh-huh.
And I have found, I ran for Congress. I lost in the primary to someone with literally 100 times more money than I did in upstate New York.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, I find that there is a disconnect between who the American people really are
uh-huh.
and who we're told we are, because
yeah.
the sentiments that you express, which are never, talk about things you can't say on the radio, you never are allowed to question the profit motive in America and the mainstream media, and yet
yeah.
I think it is a widespread sentiment out there that something is wrong with just running the society for money. That's a common attitude out there.
Yeah, well, plus when it's being shoved in your face all the time, everything from whether they're trying to sell you toothpaste or the right thing that makes you smell good or feel cozy at night, or it's all about to take care of the consumer, and when
after 911, right?
Oh,
after 911, the first thing the president says is go shopping.
Yeah,
is that really the most important point? You know,
I couldn't even believe. You know, I really could not even believe in my little local newspaper the article. You know, in 15-fold bold writing, ExxonMobil's $25 billion profit. It's like, what? You gotta. The punches just keep coming, and. What do we do? I'd like to think that I can just go on the upswing side and get in a feel-good saying with my neighbors and peace, love, happiness. But the reality is, at this rate, if these guys don't stop, I mean, it kills me to look at the real footage of Iraq, you know, of babies, you know, everybody knows it, the blood, the everything. That child, that soul, that chance just gone. You know, I'd like to think that we can just, like, change and be good, but at a certain point, how can we keep letting this go on and on? It's all of these things are coming to a head because life is saying it affects everything. We are connected to each other. We do need each other, but we also need the planet. You know, we can't, well, Cancer Alley. They don't call it Cancer Alley for nothing. You know, I mean, the profits, the pollution, the just, it's the same story all over the world. And honestly, I can't blame. I know a lot of homeless people. I have a lot of very talented homeless people come in and play music at our open mic. And there are just so many good people if they have somebody coming at them who cares. That's why
you're,
Cuba
you're in
works.
A restaurant or a bar or something with an open mic?
No, actually, it's in the back room of a church.
Okay. I'm out of time almost for this hour, so I got to just thank you, Shannon. But I know that you've expressed
perfect,
sentiments that a lot of people are feeling, and I think it's something we don't discuss enough. Randy, as we're closing down here in this hour, if you were just to say one or two or three things different that we should do, we should learn from Cuba, just list them, what would they be?
I would say that we need to listen to our neighbors. Our neighbors in the Caribbean, I definitely think there's a lot we need to learn from Cuba, and I advocate listening to our community and getting involved in our community, and everybody stop being so isolated both here and abroad. There are open travel bills in Congress to travel to Cuba, and I would ask you to support your Congress people, ask them to vote for the travel to Cuba bills, and
that would make it legal.
Get to know your neighbors.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You're talking about it would make it legal to go to Cuba without having to go through a third country or something.
Yeah, those bills are in Congress in both the House and the Senate, and I encourage everybody to please support. Ask your Congress people to support those bills.
We're out of time, Randy.
Get to know your neighbors.
Okay, Randy Poindexter of the U.S.-Cuba Hurricane Conference, I want to thank you very much. And we'll be back on the Homelessness Marathon right after a few minutes of other programming and a break. Thank you very much.
You are listening to the Homelessness Marathon, produced in conjunction with Community Radio WQRZ of Waveland, Mississippi. The opinions expressed in this broadcast are not necessarily those of the producing or participating organizations or of the originating and affiliated radio stations. To order CDs of this broadcast or to contact the Homelessness Marathon, go to homelessnessmarathon.org.